You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, brought to you by RECO, your local guide for all things real estate investing in Colorado. All right, so today's podcast is not just going to focus on real estate, but talk about stocks, equities, bonds, what's going on in a different part of the financial services. So about a year ago, I had Austin and Zach from Denver Wealth Management come to the podcast to come talk shopping with AC. You know, I spend all my time, all my energy looking at real estate. They spend their time and energy looking at stocks and bonds and opportunities there. So we've had lots of fun conversations. We've actually had lots of mutual clients as well. So I've always enjoyed learning what you guys are doing, and I know our audience has as well. So guys, I'm glad to have you back on here.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
Yeah.
It's always fun. Yeah, thanks, always Chris. Fun to talk shop.
Yeah. Austin, welcome back. Zach, welcome back. So we're recording this in mid-February, and you know, interest rates shocked real estate the last 18 months and has changed us. What have you guys seen in 2023 in terms of like what happened? Quick recap, and then going forward to like, I want to talk about where the opportunity is, because you guys, you know, you're actively managing some sectors. I've got some questions that I'm dying to ask you guys. So what was 2023 like, Zach?
Yeah. So US stock, we had the markets had a phenomenal year in 2023. The US stock market was up about 26%, which is, you know, commonly the S&P 500. The growth companies, which had a terrible 2022, were up 38%. I'm using my Morningstar metrics. There's a lot of different ways you can use these numbers, so I'm just going to tell you I'm using Morningstar for my metrics. But growth companies were up 38%. Value companies, which are kind of like the more Walmarts and Home Depots and Coca-Cola type companies, were up about 12%, which is the historical long-term return of the market. So equities definitely had a gangbusters year, and international had an okay year. International has really like underperformed the U.S. for the past 15 years, but international markets did about 15%, which is above the long-term average. So even though rates continued to go up, which is generally negative for stocks, the prices were such that money started flowing into equity markets and equity investors had a satisfactory year. It was hard to, I don't know how you could have lost money last year if you had a diversified portfolio, because pretty much everything went up double digits.
So one question I have on there, because this is what I've been looking at in 2023, and I agree, you know, it was a great growth year. You know, tech obviously came back, you know, with a rocket ship in 2023. And I might be getting these stats a little incorrect by thinking of eight stocks make up the majority of growth of the S&P 500 growth. And if you took out those couple of stocks, you know, the S&P was a much lower return than historically is. And I'm a big, you know, index fund investor. I like the broad-based stuff. But when I see that, like, I have a hard time in my mind saying, hey, keep investing everything in a broad base when it's a few stocks that are leading everything. So I'd be curious about your guys' commentary on that, thoughts on there, and how that may impact, like, portfolio allocation.
Yeah, I'll go first, Austin, then I'll let you answer too. But so we've been talking about this for, I think since 2019 was the first term this phrase came into our annual newsletter. And that's that these companies are what we call platform companies. So the seven largest, you know, they called it the Magnificent Seven.
Yes.
You know, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Nvidia, Tesla, Facebook. I missed one. Anyway, there's seven of them. And basically the reason we call them platform companies is because they are the companies that every single business is going to build their business on. So like, Chris, when you do Property Llama, I don't know what software you're using, but the chances that it's not Google, Amazon Web Services, or Apple or Microsoft is basically zero. There's when we record this podcast, there's virtually no chance it's not going to be recorded on one of those servers or systems. So regardless of who gets it, whether it's Amazon or Google or Apple or Facebook, one of those companies are getting them. And you're seeing this. So this is unlike anything else in history. We've never had six companies. You know, we can take Tesla out of there at the moment, but we've never had six companies that every single other company in the whole world is going to use. So I think it's justifiable that when you buy a market cap weighted index, you do want a lot in those companies. Now, it does create the opportunity that if people stop wanting to invest because their growth is somewhat capped, you know, these companies are now somewhere between $1 and $4 trillion. You're not going to turn $10,000 into a million in these mega cap companies. It's just not going to happen because they're too big. But will you get the 10 to 12% long-term historical return of the market? I would say it's very good chance. In fact, over the last 15 years, the NASDAQ has returned 16% a year. And that's because of these big market cap tech companies are just absolutely dominating the world. And we talk a lot about this on our podcast, Mind of a Millionaire. If you think about how Apple makes money, there's 8 billion people in the world and 1.3 billion people have a smartphone. So that means only, you know, let's just call it 1/8 of the world's population has a smartphone. So there is still room to grow. You probably won't see that crazy exponential growth. But so it does, in conclusion, I would say it doesn't bother me too much that if you are wealthy, the majority of your money is in these platform companies. But if you are trying to get wealthy, you know, if you're trying to make 10 to 12% a year or more, that's where diversifying into these other sectors can be really beneficial.
So are you, if I heard that last bit right, you're saying, hey, for as far as like getting big growth or continued big growth in these companies is, you know, lower odds, but essentially a great place to like park capital for consistent growth, maybe kind of like the new blue chip type companies where, hey, a couple of these companies, man, they're going to preserve your wealth and you perform very well.
Yes.
I was just going to agree. Yes. To Zach's point, I think those larger companies will continue to represent the S&P 500 the way it has since 1926. So you park your cash there, you're probably going to see a 10% annualized. And we can't see in a crystal ball what's going to happen, but you'll probably see that 10% annualized rate of return. If you want to outperform that, you have to find different pockets of the market to diversify across. Historically, one of those pockets is small cap companies. Small companies went on a little bit of a run to start the year. And if you were diversified there, you benefited from that, although they've been lagging before then. So I think that right there is a nod to the benefit of diversification. But also, we've seen this paradigm shift where there's no longer just small, mid, and large cap companies. There's small, mid, large, mega cap, and now these hyper cap companies where, you know, Apple's worth over $3 trillion.
Are the hyper caps the trillion plus companies?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So it's no longer just talking about large cap companies and including those hyper cap, mega cap names. So I was listening to a portfolio manager at JP Morgan talk a couple months ago, and he had a really good outlook look on, you know, where the puck is going. What are we seeing in technological advances? And while NVIDIA might be leading some of that right now, there's still a lot of traditional large cap companies at $2 billion to $10 billion, $15, $20 billion market cap that are innovators in that space and that have more room to grow than the Amazons of the world and the Apples of the world. Then you still see that in mid-cap and small-cap companies too. And I think there's also still opportunity internationally. You know, we haven't even touched on international stock, which, hate it or love it, I'm not a huge proponent. I know there are a lot of advisors in our office who do love international, but it's just one other area where you can see, I think, more innovation and more benefit and diversification.
We did a study going back to 1986 and said, when does diversification truly help us? And if you look at like 1986 to 1999, all of those years, having diversification has helped you, even in the dot-com booming era, because you had emerging markets doing well, you had international doing well. From 2001 to 2011, diversification absolutely did phenomenally better than the stock market, because that's the lost decade in the S&P 500. Where the S&P 500 didn't make any money for 10 years from a certain date in 2001 to a certain date in 2011. And emerging markets was making, you know, a 50% return a few years in a row. But that's not been the case for the last 12, 13 years. So it's been really interesting to see the difference between being diversified in the modern era versus being diversified before 2008. And frankly, it just hasn't been as good for investors as it had been before the financial crisis.
That's really interesting. So I'm curious, let's say I come to you with $1 million to place in, you know, stocks and cash and bonds. What's the high level kind of allocation? I'm in my early 40s, still in growth mode, have a high risk tolerance. What's kind of like the high level allocation or opportunities you see? Like, hey, maybe put some here, like what pops in your guys' mind?
Yeah, I would call you a growth investor. Like, not if you'd have to tell me you were aggressive growth. If you have $1 million, to a certain extent, you've already made it. Like, we don't have to, you know, try and knock the cover off the ball for your financial goals to happen. So that being said, we want the long term return of the stock market. Your biggest holding with us would be the S&P 500, just because it is a low cost, low turnover investment that has a great track record. We tend to overweight the NASDAQ. The way we like to invest that, and that is an ETF called QQQM. By the way, this is not investment advice. You better put a big fat disclaimer on this one. But, you know, we buy the NASDAQ, and we've owned the NASDAQ for a long time. There's only one mutual fund that's outperformed the NASDAQ over the past 15 years. It's Barron Growth Fund, by the way. The guy who runs it's Ron Barron. He's a super interesting guy. And he beat it by having leverage, most of his money in Tesla, and a lot of his money in SpaceX. So if you look at the thousands of growth stock mutual funds, there's only one that has outperformed the NASDAQ over a long period of time.
Wow.
Yeah, we don't try and beat, you know, Ron Barron. We own, you know, I own some Ron Barron or Barron funds. He's a good guy. He's got an interesting healthcare fund. But we'll just buy you the NASDAQ. You know, it costs 0.04% a year. It's made 16% over the last 15 years. And for a growth investor, you can handle the volatility. I think today the NASDAQ was up 2.5%, and a couple of days ago it was down like 4% over the week. So it's a very volatile investment. Maybe not the best investment for a retiree, depending on their risk tolerance. So that those two funds are going to make up a big chunk of your portfolio. But to Austin's point earlier, we still do believe in diversification, especially when interest rates are higher. One of the things that you can, what happened between 2008 and 2022-23? Well, interest rates were zero. And when interest rates were zero, it made these very growth-oriented companies very attractive. Now the interest rates are higher, it means that we think there's probably a chance for diversification to work again. So that's where you would simply be buying small and mid-sized U.S. companies. I'm not a big fan of international. You know, I think of international as a hedge. So I don't think we'd be putting a big piece of the pie in international. We certainly aren't today. But that could change. But at the moment, we're not big international investors either.
I agree with that. I've never been. I used to a little bit, and then I don't know. There's too much unknowns, and they're a lot less regulated. And plus, if you own like the S&P 500, you have international exposure through there. So last year when we talked, you guys had some interest in biotech. I want to talk about that, and also how you guys are looking at the AI potential growth sector. So I remember those were, well, last year was biotech. And I also want to talk AI. So how do you guys see those two sectors?
Biotech is Zach's a hobby. It's almost a hobby. Yeah. You can read about biotech. So I'll let you take that one and I can cover AI.
All right. The biotech thing is, I love biotech. So I'm the most biased person you'll ever talk to about biotech. And why do I love biotech? I love biotech because they are solving problems that save lives every day. And to me, that's the coolest thing. Like, I think if you want to do the most good for humanity, yes, you can donate to a charity, keep donating to your charities, but you can also invest in these companies that cure rare diseases. And one of the problems with biotech is for every five companies that cure a rare disease that saves thousands of lives, there's 95 companies that go out of business because they were unable to do so. So that being said, biotech had a really, if you look at the industry, like don't look at the stock market, just look at the actual industry. There's a ton of wins that happened in the biotech world, as far as like Alzheimer's drug, weight loss drugs. I'm not going to give any company names because it's better for us compliance-wise to not. There's a lot of individual companies that cured a lot of rare diseases, and a lot of progress was made in CRISPR technology in doing things that will provide individual cures for like cancer or individual cures for leukemia. So the progress that's been made in last year has been awesome. So if you follow biotech, like Austin mentioned, I kind of do as a hobby, what a cool year. I mean, what a great year for humanity, for the billions of dollars that gets poured into research every year. From a stock market perspective, had a good year, but it certainly didn't do as well as the S&P. The S&P was up 26%. My favorite biotech mutual fund, Eventide is my favorite guy, was up 11%. The whole industry was down a little less than that. So about a 10% return for biotech for the year. There's a few different ways you can look at it. There's the XBI ETF. There's the IBB ETF. Not a great year. And one of the reasons is with a biotech investment, one, you're buying kind of like lottery tickets. You're hoping these companies cure a disease. But two, with interest rates high, the value of a biotech company goes down. So we would expect if interest rates go down, the value of biotech companies would appreciate, but there's certainly no guarantee. So it depends on how you look at it, Chris. Like, is a 10 to 12% return in a stock in the stock market good? Yeah, that's a good long-term average. But did it do half as well as the S&P 500 last year? Yes, it did. So it did not turn into an amazing investment compared to the market. But from a underlying technology perspective, it was phenomenal.
Okay. About AI, Austin. I've got so many thoughts in here. I want to hear what you professionals think.
It's exciting. It's an area that we get a lot of questions on. I think the best way to summarize is with investing, especially in growth-oriented companies, you have to go where the puck is going. Blair says that a lot in our office, Zach's partner, but be where the puck is going. And with AI, like I mentioned earlier, there's this paradigm shift happening where that is where the puck is going. These tech companies are very expensive, and that's been a bit of a headwind, I think, for investors, and a bit of a nervous, let's wait and see what happens. Let's wait and see if prices normalize. But realistically, I mean, on the last podcast, we were talking about the Denver market, the Denver real estate market, and you don't really get opportunities like that. And so where the puck is going is maybe things are expensive, especially with this big push in AI and this big technological, I think, milestone that we're moving toward. But we see a lot of opportunities in tech companies still, even as expensive as they are.
So here from like a macro opportunity, so like, is AI going to go through like its dot-com boom? Like, you know, in the late 90s, we had the huge dot-com boom and, you know, pets.com and whatever, you know, companies worth $1 billion and most went to zero. And a lot of the real longer term companies, the Googles, the Facebooks, they happen kind of in that second growth wave. And I kind of debate, is AI, is going to be like a big kind of like boom and bust like that? And then like the longer, the winners will come out. Like, I'm curious how you guys are viewing the market from like a macro. I know it's a very hard question, but that's what, I don't know. Like, I bounce around.
Like any of these popular spaces, you're going to see the companies that are going to be around for a long time, like the NVIDIAs, the Apples, the Microsofts of the world. Even thinking about the internet boom, I think a lot of that was led by, you know, IBM. And IBM isn't as big a player anymore. They certainly went their way. And I think they're, like I alluded to earlier, there's room for these other companies to grow and emerge in this space. But like anything, you see AI everywhere. You see AI in Adobe, and you're seeing all these new companies pop up in these niche spaces. Someone was showing me a website yesterday that does text to video. And it's the coolest thing in the world, where you can write up a paragraph of what you want the video to show, and it'll populate a video that does just what you told it to do. So with things like that, it's not going anywhere, but I do think that you're going to see pockets where they're trying to fit into this. You saw it with crypto too.
Yeah.
With crypto, the big names are still there. They're still very much, they're growing. But all of the other smaller names that wanted to be a part of that fad or that push have kind of subsided. And you're seeing the money stick with some of those bigger names. So to answer your question directly, I think there's areas for certain companies to grow and thrive and emerge. I think the bigger leaders in this aren't going anywhere. But I do think that you'll see some losers in the space, absolutely.
Are you more of a fan of like buying, you know, AI companies now, or kind of like NVIDIA, where they're the picks and shovels of the gold rush of like, hey, right now everyone needs their hardware?
Diversify. I'm be completely honest with you. I'm not smart enough to pick which companies are going to be those in years to come. And companies like NVIDIA are expensive. $680 for one stock is nuts. So I think the best way to do it is to find funds, find ETFs, find mutual funds. There are a lot of great funds out there in specifically, you know, not even in the mutual space anymore, but these active ETFs have portfolio managers that are just thought leaders in the space. And when you hear them talk about where that puck is going, it's so inspirational and so motivational to just hear about all these emerging companies and what's actually going on behind the scenes in the space. So we can't pick those stocks for you. I don't know what it's going to be, but have some exposure to a lot of different companies. And I think that'll absolutely increase your chances of winning in that space.
What are your thoughts, Zach?
Yeah, I think first of all, Austin came to the conclusion I agree with, which is picking the winner is really hard. But buying an index fund, or like the NASDAQ or the S&P, where you, or even like a technology ETF, you can buy the tech sector of the S&P 500 in one standalone product. And then you are almost guaranteed to own the winner because that winner will be held within a technology index. So I have seen in our practice at Denver Wealth Management, we have had a couple people laid off in the last 6 months. And the given reason was your job is being replaced by AI.
Clients, one of the examples not employees at Denver Wealth. Just to make that differentiate. You just said at Denver Wealth, we had some people laid off.
Oh. Yeah, watch out, Denver Wealth employees. No, you're good. No, I had a client who did, like, let's say Costco wants to build a new Costco in Wisconsin. And they need, I don't know, 40 acres and blah, blah, blah. So what they do is they hire a team of lawyers to go out surveyors to go survey the land. And then they have to run that through a legal team. And then they've got to get approvals. And I had a client who was on a team on the survey legal team. He's a lawyer. And there was like 10 guys that would go out and do this. And then they would, you know, they would all review the law. They would review the I don't really know what they're doing out there. I'm not smart enough to know their actual job, but like they'd review the GPS coordinates and they'd go make a proposal, and they all got laid off. 9 of the 10 people got laid off. They started using an AI generator to do this report. And they have one employee now who reviews the AI report, which they have found is more accurate than the 9 other guys going out and doing this report.
Wow.
So if you think about like at a law firm, if person A is suing person B, the lawyers go to the court and talk about all the legal precedents. And that's what the paralegals are doing at a law firm. They're going down into the basement with the candles and reading all the ancient law to make the case for why their person should win the court case. Well, this is the dream scenario for a supercomputer, right? Or AI, as they're calling it. And AI is really making it like look like law firms would rather be relying on a supercomputer to prepare these sort of court case memorandums, I think they're called, as opposed to hiring a bunch of paralegals at $25 an hour. So I'm seeing it in real life, which is different than I could ever say in crypto. In crypto, the only thing that I ever saw people do was buy more crypto. You know, very few people were ever making meaningful real life decisions with their cryptocurrency. They were just having fun buying it back and forth. Same with 3D printing. 3D printing was a hype that 3D printers are super cool. I've got to use them now. But all you're really making, aside from some very interesting manufacturing companies, the average person, it doesn't have a 3D printer to print a spoon in their house. You know, it never really materialized. I mean, AI is materializing. So I think it's the real deal. I don't think it's going to be like a scary movie where AI takes over the world and you know runs everything, but it's using our, now that all of us are connected with phones and computers and all the knowledge has been put online, it's a way for these computers to actually do meaningful things for us. My last point, Chris, is we needed a travel policy for Denver Wealth Management because guys like Austin are flying out to New York and Albuquerque and California and meeting with clients, and shoot, we got to figure out how to reimburse these guys. I went to, I don't know if it was OpenAI or ChatGPT, and I said, hey, I have a travel policy. I need a travel policy for our company. Here's kind of what we want. And boom, it spit one out. And then I asked for a few clarifications. Well, okay, we don't want 5-star hotels, but like the average price hotel in, you know, Santa Clara, California, or whatever it was. And it gave me like a 10-page travel policy. In a minute, in, you know, 60 seconds, it was awesome. So this stuff actually seems to be pretty useful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan, but we're using it more and more, especially a lot of the content and the analyses that we're doing. And so you guys think the best way to invest is sticking with like a broad-based type ETF or fund on there? Like I go back and look at like 1999 again, or, you know, I forget what the exact year that boom was. That was happening, kind of crash right as I was getting out of high school. And it's like, hey, do you get in now or do you kind of wait for the first wave to grow and crash and get in the second wave?
Here's my hypothesis here, Chris. We had our recession in 2021, 2022. They didn't call it a recession because even though we met the technical definition of a recession, which was 2 consecutive quarters of declining GDP, we did that. But everything else was going so well, they didn't declare it a recession. Now, until 2022, I never knew someone had to declare it a recession. It reminds me of in The Office, if you've ever seen that show where the manager declares bankruptcy and he yells, I declare bankruptcy. I didn't know you had to do that with recessions, but that's what they said, you have to do that. And then we had our bear market downturn, right? The NASDAQ was down 50% or 33% and the S&P was down 20%. So we had our recession, we had our bear market downturn, And in my opinion, and I've been saying this since last year, I'm only in 1 year, but I'm 1 year and 2 months right. We're back in the bull market cycle. And typically these bull markets last 5 to 10 years. So that's my working hypothesis. We had our recession, we had our bear market, and now we've got 5 to 10 years of bull market, barring a black swan event.
Your question, Chris, to whether to buy now or wait. I think Nick Murray, I love Nick Murray. Me and Zach just talked about him in our last podcast, but he has a book called Simple Wealth, Inevitable Wealth. And he does a really good job of summarizing risk, because investors tend to associate risk with the downside. Am I going to lose all of my money? And there's absolutely a chance for volatility. It's an election year, even outside of all of these different shifting trends, which historically always brings volatility. So there is risk in investing, but that's not the risk that I think people should be focused on, like yourself as an investor, someone who has 30, 40 years to invest. The real risk is making sure that you're investing in areas of the market that are going to outpace inflation, outpace purchasing power, not only get you to retirement, but get you through retirement.
Yeah.
So the real risk is outliving your own assets. And if you wait too long, if you play it too safe and safe in air quotes and in areas like bonds are doing well right now, but not necessarily for the long term. I think you have to be invested in equities, and you have to be invested in more growth oriented equities. So get in now, or dollar cost averaging. And dollar cost averaging is always on the table.
Oh yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I two things, right? Dollar cost average, and just, hey, look at the big trend and just ride the big trend. And it's usually a lot easier to make money that way.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I know Zach, you got to wrap up here. So we'll start wrapping up here. So Austin, any closing thoughts that you want to impart before I close out here?
I kind of just gave my parting thought. Yep. I'm a young investor, and I'm always trying to find new cash to put into the market. And that's a question that we've gotten a lot over the past couple of years, is what to do with cash. CDs are great. I mean, every bank probably has a poster on their window boasting their CD rates. And CDs did a good job. And CDs being an alternative to cash, but they did a good job for the past couple of years. Now is not the time to be in CDs. Historically, we've seen in these falling rate cycles, which the Fed has been pretty vocal that that's probably what's to come, that has been the worst place for investors to be, is in CDs or cash alternatives from a return standpoint.
As rates are dropping, make sure money's on the sideline, basically.
Exactly. You don't want to be in cash. It wasn't a bad place to be necessarily, again, for the past couple of years, but now's the opportunity to start putting money in, and especially before rates drop. So if you're getting back in the fixed income instruments like bonds, when rates come down, bonds are going to get more expensive. You're going to see price appreciation in bonds outside of interest alone. And same around our conversation in the stock market, you might see intra-year volatility. You're going to see volatility on an ongoing basis, but the best time to buy is really yesterday, but today. So I guess my parting thought, my action item is, if you're sitting in cash, now's a really good time to start analyzing other opportunities and put it to work.
Great advice. Zach, I know we got to wrap up here so you can head to your next appointment. Any last thoughts you want to share?
Yeah, I think the action item that most resonates with me, and I think it's taken me about 15 years as an investor and financial advisor to say this, is it's a great time to own the stock market. It's a great time to own an S&P 500 index fund. I don't see any screaming deals. Everything is actually a little expensive. The technology is expensive. International is expensive. The U.S. is expensive. There's nothing that is making me want to take out the checkbook and get greedy. You know, Warren Buffett said, get greedy when others are fearful. There's no fear right now. And that doesn't mean, you know, Chris, to your earlier question, I don't think we're in a dot-com bubble area where if you sit back in 2 years, you're going to see things drop off 30, 40%, and you're going to get a chance to buy at a huge discount. I hope there is. It's good for me as a young investor, not that young anymore, I guess, relatively young investor, to buy when the market's down 30%. But I think it did take me 15 years to be able to just say, you know what, it's a great time to own the market, stay invested. And, you know, we don't know if we're going to be up or down 10% this year, but I certainly would rather be up or down 10% in a good investment with a good long-term track record than trying to go pick out any individual sectors that I think are going to absolutely crush it.
Thank you. Well, guys, great thoughts. Thank you for coming out onto the podcast. I always appreciate it. It's always fun to talk different sides of what's going on in the market. So Zach Austin, if people want to reach out to you, I'll definitely put your contact details out there. DenverWealthManagement.com. So we've had some mutual clients that actually worked with you guys before we met each other. And since the podcast, I've only heard good things about you. So anyone out there wants to connect with financial planners that actually own some real estate as well, I would definitely recommend you get in touch with Zach and Austin. So thank you guys.
Thanks, Chris. And I'll throw out there that we spent an outrageous amount of money to buy the domain denverwealth.com because no one could spell the word management. So we missed so many emails from prospective clients because they would spell management without the E that we figured it was worth the money to buy the website denverwealth.com.
That's so right.
Save you a few consonants there and vowels.
I love it. Great domain. Awesome, guys. Thank you so much. We'll do this again next year.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, everyone.